to the CG Pro podcast. This is episode 51, and today we have Alex Pierce. I'm very excited to welcome Alex. He's a good friend, and I'm excited to do this episode with you today, Alex. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's cool. Listen to a lot of the podcasts, and excited to be on it.
Excited to have you here. So, yeah, Alex is a senior creative technologist at LightSail VR. He's had a really interesting career, which we'll get into in a second. And if you enjoy what you hear today, you can follow us in our Facebook group or at becomecgpro.com to find out more about what we do as a school. So, yeah, welcome.
Thanks.
Yeah, so I'd always love to start this off just asking you a little bit about your background. I know you've done some quite different stuff in the past to get to this point, including being in the military and all sorts of different things in filmmaking and CG. How did this all get started, particularly, I guess, in the film and CG arena? Where did you begin? I know you started off in the military, and you probably started before that.
Yeah, I guess since you mentioned it, it'd probably be good to just chat a little bit about that. I think as a teenager, I realized that I wanted to do something in music or art, something that was a creative field. And one of the main drivers for me joining the military was I wanted to go to a good school. I wasn't sure if it was going to be music school or film school, but I knew I wanted to go to a good school. I didn't want to have crazy amounts of debt. And so that's one of the main reasons I joined the military. Pursuing music, I was a drummer for the Army, and realized kind of then that like music wasn't really what I wanted to make my career in. I loved doing it; I was really good at it. But I like most people, I loved film and I loved TV, and so I started pursuing that. Went to film school in San Francisco. San Francisco was an interesting place to be in film school, especially at that time. There's a lot of technology coming out of there, and I saw Oculus DK1, which is obviously before the DK2, really before the real usher in of the VR stuff. And I was, getting ready to graduate college, and I was trying to figure out, how do I break into the film industry? How do I make a name for myself in the film industry? And when I saw 360 Video, I thought that was going to be a good opportunity. Obviously, 360 kind of went in an opposite direction of the film and industry world, but it's a very interesting place to be at the very start of it. And so basically I kind of, my first, sort of real job, I guess you could say, in the industry was at a place called Jaunt VR, which eventually was Jaunt XR. And they were kind of the premier 360 company at the time, like 2015, 16, 17. Among other things, they made this crazy like 24 camera, 360 rig, stereoscopic, and I was part of the.
Awesome.
Yeah, it does. We have one here actually. If anyone ever wants one, it kind of looks like the Death Star. It does look awesome. It was a fantastic camera for that time, and I got to work in the studio. I was part of the my title's producer, but I basically was a director and cinematographer. I got to work on some fantastic, just amazing projects. We did a lot of sports stuff, but then, the highlights of my career there were I was the cinematographer for an Apple commercial, essentially. Basically, Final Cut Pro was releasing their 360 tools. And so I got to be the DP for this Apple spot where we traveled all over California and we shot. And because I was the DP, this is a funny side note, but the studio really wanted to use the Jaunt camera because we built this camera, blah, blah, blah. And they said, okay, Alex, you're going to be the camera operator. And I said, okay, is there a cinematographer ahead of me? Are we hiring somebody to come in? Nope. Okay, then I'm the cinematographer for an Apple spot. We can't use the Jaunt camera. And they were just, I had to argue my way out of that one. But in the end, it was true. It was like, they want to shoot 360 cinematically. They want to pay us a ton of money, obviously. Like, it's going to be a big budget thing. But like, to capture the sunrise and sunset with, the full dynamic range and colors, we needed to have something else. We built this crazy red rig and shot this crazy commercial for them. And it was great. And then the other the other great project I did was I directed this this series, short series for Kia Stinger. Kia Stinger came out in 2017. And part of it, it was a very big thing. We did a VR headset part of it. But the other part of it was actually virtual production really before, it was 2017, which was basically we had a car and we built an LED wall around the car. And I shot 360 footage in the south of France and the UK and in California. And we projected it onto the LED wall. And we did a car thing, but it was for the Detroit Auto Show. And people would get in the car and they could drive it. The car was on hydraulics and was moving. Cool. And so it was really like, you know, people asked when I got into virtual production, it's like kind of in 2016, like in a way I was doing it back then. But it was a very cool project to be a part of. It was very innovative in the way we shot it and the way we did post. And it was really what sparked my love for CG, because the car was all the car was CG. Obviously the car hadn't even been released yet. And it was great because we could have perfect stereo, you know, it could be an interior car and have perfect stereo, which for me was like, wait, we were doing everything in stereo, but like perfect stereo was always a challenge. Mm. And it was all this like, you know, post work that we'd have to fix a nuke to like really work. And this is like, wait, CG can be perfect stereo 360 3D. This is cool. So I really went down the 3D path that time, you know, 2016, I started using Blender. At the time I was using Unity a lot because we were also doing like interactive video experiences. And so went down that path. The next place I went to, I was there for about 3 years, a place called Miller Creative. And what I did there was I started their VR training arm, basically. And we mostly did stuff for United Airlines. So we did a lot of VR training for United Airlines. Some more simple, some more complicated. The last one I worked on was a kind of a simulator to dock the jet bridge. So all done in Unity, and we used Blender and we used a mix of things. But it was a very, very detailed experience. It was very useful for the people who used it. I mean, honestly, even today, if I had to, I could dock a jet bridge to a plane, pretty much any plane in any jet bridge, which is pretty crazy. But yeah, so that sort of got me down that path. While I was there, I started getting into virtual production. This is pre-COVID. I saw the use case, the benefits, and I actually pitched it to the company that I was working for that, like, hey, you know, we could use this in our training. You know, we could build one of these, you know, a smaller but a pretty sizable LED wall. And instead of having to go to the airport every time we need to shoot a training video, we could actually just do it on site. And there'd be a lot of benefits to that outside of, you know, because you just think of the logistics of, you know, getting to an airport and like, oh, now I need to like close off this gate so we can shoot some stuff. And at the time they were just, yeah, exactly. At the time it was just like, it was too busy to even really consider it. So we kind of went on the back burner, and then COVID happened, and we did get a few opportunities to use virtual production. First one we did was a green screen virtual production, and I was remoting in from LA, controlling this machine in Chicago, and doing all this crazy CG stuff. And it was a really good, it was a good experience. The client loved it. It was a little bit nerve-wracking, especially not being in Chicago. It was kind of like you kind of have to have people there and to do the actual virtual production, and they did. They eventually hired somebody, an Unreal artist, and then for me, like, my love for virtual production and Unreal Engine specifically really grew and was taken off. But we were still very much based in Unity, and I couldn't really be a part of the virtual production team because it really, you kind of need to be there to do it. So eventually I left that company, and then I joined this company, Lightsail VR, where I'll tell a little bit about the company here in a minute, but basically my other business partners wanted me to pursue virtual production. They wanted me to keep going down the path of Unreal, virtual production, CG, and they wanted to bring those capabilities into the company. So it was actually perfect because I didn't know what I wanted to do at the time. You know, when I left my last company, I just knew that I wanted to build my own company. I didn't want to build someone else's because I just did that. And I wanted to do something with virtual production. And so joining as a partner really gave me the opportunity to do both. And it's been, I guess almost 3 years now, I guess 2 years. And it's been great. It's been really good. We'll get into all about virtual production and all that in this throughout the course of this, but we've used some of the technology from virtual production to do just normal post-production. So I'll give you the best example is for Foo Fighters. So we did last year, Foo Fighters did a concert for Meta in VR. And we also did a regular 2D concert. So Lightsail VR handled all of the post-production, the editorial for both concerts, all the visual effects and everything. So we had a very short time from the time we shot the video, the content, which is 40 minutes long concert. We had like a few weeks, like 2-3 weeks before the Super Bowl. So one of the big question marks are how we're going to do the visual effects in time. And so what we did was we used virtual production technology with traditional VFX. So what we did was we used a Stipe camera system and we captured all the tracking data live. And then we did all the post VFX using that tracking data. So we didn't have to post track 40 minutes of footage. We could, you know, from day one, we could just go in and start doing the VFX. And the VFX were done in Notch, which is a real-time render engine and very audio reactive effects built in. So it was a very interesting concert and VFX stuff did. But it's just to say that we combined some of the stuff, even stuff that's not actually technically virtual production, using some of the technology from there to bring it into the other side of the business, which is the VR side of the business.
It's interesting you bring that up because there's a lot of debate out there I see about what is virtual production, even sometimes argument around that.
Like, sure.
What is virtual production? And I'm interested to know, you know, your take on it.
What is virtual production? That's a great...
won't like hold you responsible for the
industry. Sure I think it's a good question. Essentially, it's in my opinion, it's kind of like when you take any sort of VFX, anything that's later, and you bring it to the forefront, whether that's for previs, you know, if you're using previs to if you're bringing CG into previs and do stuff, that's virtual production. If you're using camera tracking at all in some way, it's probably also considered virtual production. Certainly, and this probably may start a few fights, but green screen, if you're doing on-set compositing so you can see what the final result will be, that's, in my opinion, that's definitely, you know, virtual production. And then all the way to in-camera visual effects is, of course, obviously virtual production. But I do think in general, there's a lot of things and a lot of these other ones, the green screen, you know, a great example of, like, you know, it is still absolutely virtual production. If you can see, even if it's just sort of what it's going to look like in the end, it is helping and informing the process of how you shoot and hopefully informing your lighting, because the lighting is obviously such a key part. So all that sort of stuff, in my opinion, is under the umbrella, which is virtual production. I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think it's important because the LED wall is what gets all the hype and attention.
Right.
But there's all this other stuff going on. Some of the projects I've worked on have been not LED walls, but still considered formative virtual production projects. It's important for people to know as well, because I think that while there's a lot of other things going on, the LED walls can be really expensive some LED walls are becoming very affordable, but I know that a lot of it is expensive and people think that they can't therefore do virtual production because of that, because they don't have the budget for it. But
yeah,
it's really, really good to know how useful it can be and what things it represents. And there's always different takes on that. So it's really good to hear about it.
Yeah.
So how, how did you get started with CG coming across to coming back to the CG conversation? What's some of the first kind of tools that you learned and how you learned them?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I'll skip all the stuff that's sort of not really CG in my opinion, like the stuff I was doing in After Effects or whatever. It was really Blender. It was when I was at Jaunt and I was seeing stuff that people were doing in CG. I was seeing some of the things we were doing, and I was looking at obviously the cost of Maya was insane, and was like, I can't really justify. I'm a director and a cinematographer, so I can't really justify to my work that I need to like buy software just because I want to learn it, and it seems like it would be useful for me as a director later. So Blender was obviously a great choice because it's free, and so I was like, okay, well, let me check this out. I think it was right before the 2.8 release when I started using it. And it was just sort of like, just getting my feet wet and trying some things and doing some tutorials here and there. When 2.8 came out, I really started going down the rabbit hole and using Blender. At the last company I was at, I would hire teams of people to do projects. I would oversee the projects. But I always sort of in the background would start learning as much as I could about Unity at the time. Mainly Unity and Blender were the things I was learning at the time. And those are the programs that definitely when I got into CG. And even though I didn't need to, I just felt like as a manager, somebody who was like overseeing other artists, I needed to at least understand more about what is possible, what's not possible. When someone would tell me like, oh, we can't do that because X, Y, or Z, I wanted to understand that better. And then really when COVID hit is really when I actually became a 3D artist, because I had teams of vendors working on various projects, and all of a sudden we had to pay them out on all the stuff that we owed them. And then we couldn't hire them for anything because COVID and all the projects were frozen. And at our company, we went from like 85 active projects to 80 or to 5. So we lost 80 active projects, and those 5 that were left were all my projects, but I didn't have a team to work on them. So I worked
active projects is impressive.
And they were all live action. 80 of them were live action stuff that had to stop because of COVID. So I had to very quickly, all the like gaps in my knowledge, I had to quickly learn how to do all these different things. And so I spent 80 hours a week for 6 weeks straight when COVID started, just learn. And when I wasn't working on the projects, I was learning how to do the thing, to do the on the other project, to do the, it was kind of crazy, but it was also, it was a boot camp for CG really, because I had all these gaps. A lot of my knowledge is sort of plugging the leaks, or it's all the gaps between where even before that, it was like I had this team of people doing stuff, but there'd be something missing, like getting from Blender to Unity, or if it was like the lighting was the thing that was like, I need to do better lighting. So I learned, really went down the rabbit hole, learned like how to do lighting as well as I could in Unity. And back then I did a lot of baking lighting in Blender so that I could use it in Unity, but it looked photoreal. You could use the path tracer from Cycles. So it looks like it's path tracing, but it's all baked in. And then UV unwrapping and map. Oh man, I spent months just doing like crazy workflows, making my own workflows, my own plugins to do so I could bake lighting and pack the textures better and more efficiently, because I also did a lot of web 3D stuff. So we would host models on an enterprise account with Sketchfab, and then we would embed those models into like e-learning training, so you could see, you know, you're doing an online class, and then you could pop up like a 3D model of a 737 or something, and then you could, you know, interactively move around it. But it was crazy, when I really went into Blender, because it was just obviously, as you know, like Blender and Unreal are both just like never-ending. You could spend your entire life trying to learn everything about them, and there's still more. And specifically with Blender, like by the time you learn one thing, they've implemented a new feature or a new, you know, thing that might even make that thing obsolete. So then you're like on to the next thing. You're like, okay, now I kind of need to rethink how I do all of this because now there's geometry nodes or whatever it is. So that's it's the that's I think the best and worst thing about CG. For me, I think it's a great thing because I love being able to continually learn stuff and continually solve problems. It's basically for me, CG is like a puzzle. It's like, how do I solve this thing? And it's a puzzle that there's more than one way you can put it together. So how do I solve this in the most efficient way? Or how do I solve this in the most beautiful way? It's kind of depends on what type of puzzle you want to work on. But yeah, it can be frustrating for
How
sure,
much time you've got?
especially if you step away from it for a while and then you come back and you're like, oh crap. Now what? So much has changed since the last time I was here. So yeah, but now that's sort of what got me into it.
And Blender, but we're originally was a choice. Part sounded like partly because of the budgets and the costs
At
of it.
first, yeah, absolutely. The first reason was definitely cost. It was a no-brainer. I didn't have to like ask for a budget or anything. But at my last company, it was choice. In my last company, I could have paid for Maya. We had my main modeler was using Maya, and I could have asked to buy Maya. Certainly, we had the budget for it. But for me, it was like, and I spent a lot of time actually with him. We'd be and we'd do some Zoom meetings all the time, and we'd go back and forth of like what's better in Maya and Blender. And a lot of this, there was still, especially at that time, there was still a lot to love about Maya that the Blender can't really do that, and Blender's not as good in this area. But then there was things that we found all the time that like, wait, it takes you how long to do that in Maya? It's like I can do that with a click of a button, and I can make a plugin that does it, automatically. And but now it's kind of like it's night and day. Like now the choice would definitely be capability over the cost. Like costs aside, it would be. Oh, but it's more capable. Oh, but but even at the time, like cost was a factor because, and I'll remember this because when we did, because we did a lot of different things, but one of the things we did, we would do rendering for photos and we did some animation sequences and stuff. And, we had a small, I would say I had a very small render farm, but being able to render on multiple machines was a big benefit because obviously you can spread the load out. And even if you just have three or four machines, I mean, it makes the time, and also the render times in general were less on Blender than Maya. So it did kind of come down to cost, I guess, in the end there as well. But it was more of a choice than and it was more because I did think it was capable. And I felt like it's funny now because it's totally different now. But at that time, I spent a lot of time arguing with people about why Blender was better than whatever tool they were using and why I thought Blender was going to be much bigger than whatever DCC they were using. And of course now it's a completely different subject because now everyone pretty much agrees.
Yeah, no, it's got really interesting. I think everybody in the various professional industries that use 3D tools saw Blender as it was a while ago,
Right.
which was a hobbyist tool,
Yep.
and didn't really take it too seriously. And it was definitely 2.8 for me that made me start paying attention to it, having a
Yeah.
consistency, having stability, a proper interface. It was, yeah.
Left click select.
Yeah, just that one thing, just that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a big deal, and now I'm hearing more and more from people that saying similar things to you. Basically, that it's not the cost that's the first consideration. Because for a bit there, it was maybe like, well, it's free, we can save a bit of money here, but
Yeah.
now it's becoming more used in even big visual
Oh
effects
yeah.
studios. Now, whether it's hooking into their pipelines as deeply as Maya has just yet or not, it's actually being used by professionals and in a high-end context.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think the bigger the one of the biggest barriers still, I think, with in general, which is changing very quickly, is just the talent pool. You know,
Yep.
the, there that was one of the problems I had when I was at my last company of I wanted to find really excellent Blender artists, but a lot of times I couldn't find them because for different various reasons. But now that's changed a lot. Now you can specifically, I used to have to find, and in fact I did, I would find 3DS or Maya artists, and then I would more or less work them into my pipeline as opposed to the other way around. But that's all changing because all these people, everyone's pretty much familiar with Blender now. Even if they still use Maya or 3ds Max as their main thing, almost certain they have used Blender for certain things, or they use Blender for certain things. And if they had to, if someone was like, hey, I need a Blender artist, they would feel comfortable switching to Blender to do it because they understand the pros and cons of it. They understand the theory of it, and they're open to it. Whereas before, that was kind of like you ask a 3ds Max person or a Maya person, hey, are you open to switching to Blender? It was just kind of like a non-starter. It was like, no, why would I do that? It's like
it took me so long to learn this thing. Do I really have to do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I built my career on Maya as well, and I'm still probably a little faster in Maya than I am in Blender, but rampantly going after Blender every time I do something in 3D that warrants a DCC, and it's my go-to as well.
Yeah.
So
and luckily there's a course that can train you.
Really, tell me about that. Yeah.
Well, I heard this company CG Pro. I think they're doing a Blender course coming soon, aren't they?
It is true. Yeah, a shameless self promotion moment. Yeah, we are doing a Blender course. And Alex is one of our instructors. So if anyone's interested in learning Blender professionally, Alex and Mike Hodgetts are the two instructors in this class who are going to be teaching Blender for professionals. And that's a course which is coming up pretty soon. So if anyone's interested out there, then sign up while we still have some spots. But I'm very excited about this one because we've done a lot of trainings in other tools. We've been considering various DCCs and teaching Houdini and considering what to do in the DCC world. And I'm very excited to have Blender as an option and to be working with you on it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm real excited as well. I've been thinking about it for a long time because, you know, I have a YouTube channel and I love giving away all the knowledge I can for free. but I've thought about it for years. I thought, well, it'd be great to put together a professional course that, like, if you want one-on-one instruction, you know, you get it, but obviously it has to be at a price just at the, you know, and so it's like, but how do you create a professional course and how do you, so it's gone back and forth of like, how do you do this? So obviously to be working with you guys is great because you already have the reputation of teaching professional courses. And obviously you are also a Blender user and a Blender enthusiast. And I do think that it's a very important step for users to get professional one-on-one training in Blender, because for a lot of reasons. And one of the reasons is, you know, a lot of artists, when they learn a program, they go through specific training. With Blender specifically, there's a million free tutorials out there, which is great. I mean, one hand, that's amazing because so many great resources. But on the other side, it's tricky because they're also all over the place and what do they train and what are the fundamentals and how do you do this and how do you do that. And like learning any software, it's tricky if you don't have somebody you can ask questions to. So yeah, I think I'm real excited. It's going to be a great course. I think me and Mike are a great team. Mike is my lead 3D modeler at Lightsail. He's the one I hired to do any kind of 3D modeling task. I hired him because he's one of the best Blender users I've ever met. He has such a great knowledge base. He's been using it for like 15 years or something. And he has a very, very solid foundation. Whereas me, I'm a little bit more all over the place. And so I think we're a great team because there's so many things about Blender that make it just really special because there's all these other things you can do with it. And I know a lot about these other things you can do with it. And I know a lot of the technical side of it, the scripting side you know, how to do some really interesting stuff with pipeline work and whatnot. So I feel like we're a good duo, good cop, bad cop kind of thing.
What, and tell us a bit about what, where, because I know you've used a lot of 3D tools, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. used Unity a lot and Blender and now Unreal, I know a lot.
Yeah.
Where does Blender come in as a good companion to, or where does it slot into the workflow for you best?
So, you know, specifically thinking of a Blender Unreal pipeline, I think I could speak to some of that, but I think in a general sense, I think what's great, Blender is just so flexible and really, and it's one of those things that a lot of people don't even think about or get into, but because it's open source, because of the way that it's their scripting is done with Python, you can really automate so many things. And it's very easy even to make your own plugins. You don't have to distribute them. You can if you want, and give them away for free. You can sell them if you want, whatever. But it's very simple to create even your own add-ons, especially now with ChatGPT. You can make scripts to do all sorts of things. And that's one of the things that I'll show in the course. But like, you know, one of the things I had to figure out before was like, how do I make my own pipeline between Unreal or Blender and Unreal? And basically what I would do is I would script and export, and I'd create a button so that when you press this button, it exports the selected objects in a very specific format of FBX that I wanted, with the specific things applied and these things unchecked. And to do all that took me, I don't know how many hours of research and like trying this, that, and the other. And with ChatGPT, I can basically get 90% there. And then because Python is so readable, I can actually just change the things that I need to change. And so for getting to and from programs is much easier than like, you know, trying to get from a lot of programs, because the different scripting languages in a lot of these programs, they're not as user-friendly. They're not as easy to access. There's definitely not the online community of people that you can ask. And then with ChatGPT, it just makes it that much easier, because it's all, pretty much everything is already online. So there's, ChatGPT already has most of the stuff it needs to know in order to write you a decent code. So write me a script to do this or that. And it already has a pretty good base to do all that. So specifically with Unreal, there's a few different ways you could do it. There's a few different flavors you can use, like FBX or GLTF or USD. But using FBX, for instance, it's not that difficult to just make an exporter so that you can press a button and whatever you have selected in Blender automatically exports and goes into your opened Unreal project and more or less automatically import. And that process is great. It's a really great way of working it. And then depending on what you are doing and what you need to do, some people want to make their collisions in Blender. There's a lot of other add-ons and free or otherwise that you can use to do a bunch of stuff in Blender that then goes to Unreal. And then of course there's things like, you know, you can bake down the textures. If you have some crazy procedural material that you've built in Blender, it's not too difficult to just bake those down into a PBR workflow that then can easily get translated to Unreal. But it, you know, it all depends. I mean, it's certainly on the modeling side, using Blender almost exclusively. On the Unreal side, sometimes it's better to, as you know, sometimes better just to recreate the materials in Unreal. So it kind of depends on what the project is, where the assets are coming from. Like, are we buying these assets? Are we creating them from scratch? A lot of times if we're buying the assets from some store or somewhere, those can go directly into Unreal. And sometimes that's fine. And whatever, if you need to make little changes here or there, you can do that with Unreal's tools. But obviously if we need to do some cleanup, or if there's something that's not quite working, then we might need to bring it back to Blender before going back to Unreal. So yeah, we use Blender in lots of different ways. Because we definitely use it to render a lot of things as well. On our on smaller projects, and when I say smaller, I don't necessarily mean budget wise but just complexity wise. Like, for instance, we have a thing we're doing now where we have a bunch of different, I gotta think about NDAs here. What can I say? Okay. We basically have a bunch of different interior rooms that we need to render out in 360. And, you know, so there's no brainer. Like, we just, start to finish, we'll do everything in Blender, 100% of it in Blender. Mike's doing 90% of the work. And, you know, using cloth sims and using all sorts of different things, but doing the rendering and even the compositing, all that stuff's happening in Blender. And if it grows in complexity, that's where it really becomes like, even if we're just using, you know, even if we're just rendering frames out, it becomes maybe we should use Unreal for this project, because like a lot of tools, if you scale, especially like we have this one right now that's like a full city scale, 1,000 buildings or more, plus animations of trees and grass and foliage and cars and other things I can't talk about. And doing it in Blender, it could be done in Blender, but Unreal is a much better suited tool for that, just in terms of like, it doesn't care how much you throw at it. In fact, the more you throw at it, it just eats it up, especially with Nanite. It's just like, sure, give me that. I'll take that. You want to put this crazy building, you know, in the background? Fine. We'll do that, and we'll just take care of it automatically for you. So, you know, I think it's going to get harder and harder, especially as hardware gets better too. Like Blender is pretty fast to render things out. It's pretty fast to do things. But but as we have the bigger projects, it's sometimes better to do in Unreal. But yeah, anyway, I think that answers the question.
Yeah, no, great answer. They work well together, and I know that there's still other tools that you've mentioned being great, you know, Unity and Notch, and there's always for me, it's always the right tool for the right job. But really cool to see how Blender's become a professional DCC that can plug the gap in terms of modeling for sure, and rigging, and being able to create things from scratch essentially, and then bring them into Unreal or just render them there in Blender. We got a couple of questions that have come in.
Yeah.
So someone is asking, how can virtual production work with digital marketing? That's a big
digital big marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's I'm not sure on what
it's quite
what
a broad question. So
yeah. I mean, I think
asked it, I guess if you want to ask a sub question to that, but maybe talking to it could be, yeah, marketing is a very, very a big subject, but it could be commercials.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, certainly, like, you know, it certainly does, and in general, this is true not even just for virtual production, but anything CG related. So it's all really use case driven. Like, what specifically, you know, is it are we talking about shoes? Are we talking about, you know, but in general, I think for marketing campaigns, I don't want to pretend like I know a ton about it, but when we did the Apple thing, for instance, we basically shot a VR piece, and we also shot a whole 2D piece with stills and everything else. We basically spent, you know, we basically did a whole marketing campaign, 10 days shooting, that was going to be used for a whole year. So they reused assets again and again and again and again. And in that case, I think virtual production is really well situated to do that, because you know, you can typically have a bigger budget, so you can go into a stage and you can shoot a lot of different setups in a few days that you can use just throughout the entire year. And then you have a whole funnel of content that you can just go to. I think I see there's a social media for clarification. But yeah, I think virtual production can be used in any industry across anything. Where it makes sense, you know, that becomes a lot more case by case, and like, you know, how much budget do you have does play a factor in it, but how much prep can you do before you get to the shoot? You know, a lot of times the problems, the challenges with virtual production are that the cash flow is different. So even on a lot of films, it's typically you don't pay for the post-production when you're in pre-production. You shoot the whole film, you do a bunch of stuff, you use that as leverage to get more funding to do your post-production. So it's a little bit challenging for producers on big films to say, okay, but you know, all that other money we want, you know, however many $20 million that we need, we actually need it now a year in advance. That is a trickier thing to sort of to figure out. But I think with digital marketing stuff, especially if you can be more agile, if you can hire a team to create your content, you can hire artists to do these things, there's obviously a lot of time saving, which can come with cost saving as well. I don't know if that answered the question or not, but.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I think it was Gigi was asking specifically about social media, which I guess is an outlet for marketing, a big one, probably the biggest one.
Gigi, we went to school together. Hi, Gigi. Gigi, been a while. Oh yeah, let's see, what we got here. We got Romeo 615. How's it going, man? Just getting off the full screen so I could see.
Your answer kind of said it all in a way that really the output, the outlet, dictates a little bit in how these things get budgeted. And if you're talking about virtual production, like the LED wall type virtual production where you do need to do everything up front, then really looking at how do you allocate your budgets? Do you have the budget up front, in which case you've got that pool to draw from? Are you making a movie, in which case you maybe don't have that yet? So I think that kind of covered it. We have a couple other questions here that we can ask as well. So VR in Unreal Engine, how much and what do you need to scrap in a project for good performance in a VR experience?
I don't know that I'm the best person to ask that, to be honest. So at Lightsail VR, we mostly do, on the VR side specifically, we mostly do high-end 360 video and 180 video. And we mostly work with Meta, and we have a few other big companies we work with. We have, the company has done interactive 360 stuff before. We have done VR experiences here and there, but it's been a while since I've actually done traditional VR to be put on a VR headset and played. And the game has changed quite a bit because obviously Unreal 5.1 and 5.2, there's been a lot of things that have been updated in the VR stuff. So I don't really know if I have the best answer or am the authority to talk about how to optimize for a VR headset in terms of like a VR game.
How about on the 360 side, getting CG to be 360 is something that you do. Unreal Engine's tricky. It's a tough problem because of the nature of its renderer, and with other renderers, ray tracing is easier in some sense to be able to get a 360.
Yeah.
Although you can get one from UE.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I can speak to that side. So rendering 360 video out of Unreal is very painful. There is a plugin that sort of does it, but even with an A6000, it'll crash and just you run into issues. And then if you try to do it stereo, it's like some of the effects work, some of them don't. And so I've actually thought about making my own renderer in Unreal and creating my own rig. And I've actually thought about doing it in a way that you would actually still stitch it like you would a regular 360 camera. And I think that would be a way to get around some of the limitations of like what effects you can use and that sort of thing. But the short answer there is that typically if we know we have to render full 360, stereo or mono, we'll either do it in Blender, or if we had to use Unreal today, I would use Octane in Unreal to render it out in 360. There's pros and cons of using Octane for Unreal, but using Octane, you can render, Octane in general is a great, it's really great at rendering 360. It can handle stereo, no problem. And even some of the lens effects and stuff you can actually add with Octane. So if we had a project already built in Unreal and I had to like render it out 360 and needed to look photoreal, that's, I guess, another big part of it, then I probably would lean heavily on using Octane.
Got it. Yeah, great insight. Romeo is saying we need an episode on how to land a good job in the VP scene and discuss the money in virtual production, what's real and what's smoke and mirrors. Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely do that. We did have a previous webinar that we did on the industry, which you can check out on our YouTube channel. That's worth having a look at. It goes through some of the roles and jobs. But yeah, good point. Thank you. What else do we have? So Josh is asking, what are the top programs that you recommend to get familiar with for those that are just starting with their virtual production journey?
It's tricky. I mean, you know, I think, I know you know this, it's like virtual production is, in general, is a very broad topic. And there's, in a very simple way, there's basically the artist side of virtual production and there's the technical side of virtual production. And they really are kind of two different skill sets. There are people who can do both. I suppose in a way I can do both. But in general, they're so different in their disciplines that I would recommend you either do one or you do the other. So for example, on the technical side, you know, you have to deal with lots of things like video IO, video in and out. You have to deal with how do you do Genlock and in display, even though I think it's going to be phased out eventually. Like you have to learn all these things about in display and then specific things, how to launch this and how to do that, that don't really apply to somebody who's creating an environment for virtual production. So I think first I would start with which one interests you more just in general. And then depending on which one it is, it's a very different, in my opinion, it's a very different career path. On the environment side, I think it's a little bit more, it's a lot more flexible because you could also get work in other places. Even if it's just in the meantime, you can say, I'm an environment artist working in Unreal. And then you can work at whatever place that does CG or uses Unreal for games or whatever. On the technical side, it's obviously it's a niche. It's already a niche market. And, you know, getting in to one of these companies that use it could be difficult. But at the same time, it's such a small community that everyone sort of knows everyone. And there's still such a demand for technical artists on the virtual production side that I feel like you can probably, you know, make a career for yourself just by meeting a few people, saying, hey, these are my skills. I want to learn more. I highly recommend, in general, I highly recommend, you know, volunteering to help whoever, you know, just if you don't, especially if you don't have, you know, skills to or portfolio of work, that's great. Just, hey, I'm happy to, you know, if you have a scene, I would love to just create a scene for you. You on your next thing that you're doing, you want to do a space landscape? Cool. I'll do it. I'll do it for free. No questions asked. I just want the experience. And if you show promise, you show like these companies will like if you're really good, they're likely going to hire you. If they don't hire you, you have something now for your reel that you can show the next time that you have an opportunity. But yeah, I think that networking is also a big part of all of that. You know, going to the events if you can, going to the online events, being a part of CG, you know, like LinkedIn, being a part of CG Pro is a great place because there's a lot of industry professionals at CG Pro and people who are just generally want to help people. And then all the Facebook groups, whatever, you know, learn whatever you can, meet whoever you can, and then do the thing that you love, do it really well, spend a lot of time doing it, building your own portfolio, all that sort of stuff is all helpful.
Yeah, great advice there. Yeah, I always try and put it simply as being keep growing your skills and keep growing your network. But being really specific about what you love, I think is a great point. Having, because that's what you're going to get better at. You're going to get best at what you love doing.
Yeah.
Another question here. What are your plans to help minorities in the VP scene? Great question. And I can answer that one from CG Pro's perspective. We have, separate to CG Pro, started a nonprofit called CG Empowers, which is a relatively recent thing, but that the sole intention of that is to help create more diversity in the industries that we've spent a lot of time in, which have not had enough diversity in them, whether that be people from different backgrounds, economically, ethnically, more women in the industry, that kind of thing, is something which we care about a lot. And we created a whole different organization to help with that specifically. And just so happens that we have our first event. We created a new conference called the CG Summit, which is, again, a separate organization. The first one of those is actually a fundraiser for CG Empower. So anything that we raise, it's all free to attend, but we are taking donations and sponsorships, and anything goes directly to getting people into trainings, high-end trainings, to help people move ahead in the industry. But we'll have some more to follow up on that, but something we care about a lot.
On my end, I can't really say I have, a ton. It's certainly something that at LightSail that we, in our hiring process, we're very mindful of. And we did hired a full-time Unreal Engine artist. He's an African-American. But I got to be honest, it had very little to do with my decision-making. It wasn't like, he was the best candidate, in my opinion. He wasn't, in general, he wasn't didn't have the best reel or didn't have this, but his drive and his passion for CG, married with what he already does know in Unreal, was a huge deciding factor for me. And it definitely does make me happy that, like, as a company, we're a small company, but we can have, we do have more diversity because of him. But honestly, it's who he was that drove that whole conversation forward.
Another question we got was, have you packaged or delivered a UE project to a VR HMD system? What is this process like? I know you sort of somewhat answered.
Yeah, I have. So I used to do, I have to the Pico 2 headset, which is a great headset especially for enterprise. And we're doing the training stuff for United. They bought several hundred Pico 2 headsets. So I did process Unreal. In fact, I have a tutorial that still gets tons of comments and views, which is kind of sad because that's an older headset now. And that was on like UE4. And that was several years ago. So I honestly don't even remember much about doing it. I remember it was painful trying to figure it out. That's why I made a video, so that the next person who had to try to figure it out, they wouldn't have to go through all the hoops that I did. The great thing about Unreal as opposed to Unity is that they, starting with that template that they have, and now I think especially with OpenVR, it's much more robust than it used to be. I think if you've never done it before, I would just say start with the template they have for OpenVR, OpenXR, I think is what it's called, and just don't even try to add anything to the scene. Just try to package it for, if you're going to the Quest or if you're going to the Pico or whatever headset you're going to. Just package it up, and because if you try to like take your existing project and do it and it doesn't work, you're going to be in a lot, you're not going to know where to start. But if you can package it with the default settings, then you could always work backwards. You could always take the stuff from that project and migrate it to your project. You could learn how they did it and then apply it. Or you could even start with the template and then build your whole project around it, which is what I did when I built it myself. That's what I did. I just took the default template and I took out everything from that level. I added my stuff to it, the art stuff to it, and then I just packaged it up. And so I didn't really write any of the blueprints very, very few of the blueprints did I have to, actually have to write. Most of it was just built in, which is, again, that's one of the great things about, about Unreal, is that they have the template set up for you.
Anything that gets things that you don't need to be doing out the way and helps you focus on the creative.
Yeah.
Someone else is asking, any big push to help military veterans transition into the CG world? I think I know where this comes from. So yes. And you can help us with that, I think. But Alex, I know this is probably near and dear to your heart as well.
Yeah.
Coming from that world.
Yeah. Again, on my side, specifically, I don't have, we're a small company. We don't, I don't know that we have any, any specific thing that could help with that. I'm certainly open to, as a veteran myself, of course, I do think that in general, there should be more, and especially like military does do it. a decent job of like having things like job fairs and that sort of thing. But it would be great to see, you know, really for the bigger companies, you know, the big companies to do, you know, to really do stuff. But I'm certainly happy to, like, you know, if someone knows of an opportunity, and this also goes back to the diversity thing, if there's anything I can do to help, whether it's, you know, specific tutorials or making introductions or whatever, like, you know, I'm happy to help, you know, in general. So if you have anything in mind, please let me know. And, you know, with CG Empowers, if there's anything that I can do as a veteran to help out, you know, please let me know.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And yeah, we're also at CG Pro as a school, we do have a veterans discount. So there's something we're doing to try and help that community as well.
Yeah.
Anymore.
It's a good question. It's a longer question for later, but I don't know if CG Pro could somehow use like the GI Bill or some sort of veterans benefits to, so the military pays directly instead of the veteran. But my guess is probably, the short answer is probably no, because it's not like a college per se. So I don't know if that would work, but I definitely let's chat about it offline, because maybe there is some way, or there's some, you know, maybe you have to apply for something, but it would be interesting if we could find a way to make it work where the military would pay, because obviously they pay for the GI Bill, they pay for college and other things, and they do have some sort of programs to pay for things that aren't necessarily college, because they do, like, it's been a while since I've looked all this stuff up. So let's just take this can be an offline conversation, but thanks for the question, because I think it does get the wheels turning and make me think about how can we give back to the community. Yeah. So yeah.
Look forward to digging more into that for sure. Somebody else says, I've been looking at Octane and I wonder what the cons are.
Yeah. Octane, I have a love hate relationship with Octane. The thing, and I've said this before, actually it was for a CG Pro thing. I think I had a whole talk on Octane for Blender, I think specifically, but, the main reason to keep your eye out for Octane is they do have their own real time path traced engine called Brigade, that is going, it already lives. It is already a real thing that's in closed beta. And it's coming, it's been in development for like 10 years. And the thing to keep in mind is Unreal is a real-time engine. It's not path tracing. It's still a raster engine. Octane's Brigade is a true real-time, true path tracing engine, meaning, you know, 4K, 30 frames a second, real path tracing. You know, think of quality of cycles or whatever your favorite render engine is, but in real time. And that, you know, the biggest benefit in my mind is over Unreal, besides the look, right, is all the render passes that come with that. So the render passes, you know, a big challenge of using Unreal for post VFX is you're very limited on your render passes. You can sort of do Z depth, you can sort of do Cryptomat, you can sort of do these things. Some of them work better than others. There's a lot of workarounds to make them work. Whereas Octane has a million different, you know, render passes, and you can customize anything you want, any kind of AOV you can imagine, you can do. And so to be able to do that with real time, is going to be insane, and whatever hoops you have to jump through to make it work will probably be worth it, because at that quality, it's going to be insane. So that's my preface to say that, like, right now it's tricky, because Octane is, like, you know, the way Octane works is, like, they have a standalone application that you can render in, but it's not, you can't really use it for anything more than a still image. So basically they like tie into all these different programs like Blender, Houdini, Unreal, Unity, whatever. And there's pros and cons to that. And the pros in theory is that you can work in Blender, then you can bring it over to Unreal, then you can bring it over here, you can render it standalone. That's in theory. In practice, it doesn't work that well, to be honest. In practice, you kind of want to just say, I'm going to use Octane for Blender, and that's going to be what I use. And we render in that, and we go from there. So it's that one of the big challenges is that, like, with Blender, for instance, on a smaller project, not a big deal. You can do whatever. As the project grows in scale, you start running into issues one way or the other. It's going to be hard for you to figure out Is this a Blender bug? Is this an Octane bug? Where is the, where am I having these issues? How do I fix this issue? Oh, there's a new version of Blender that breaks everything. Like, there's a lot of challenges to overcome, and I think that, you know, in general, I don't recommend people to just go learn Octane just for the sake of it. I think for very specific pipelines, it's very powerful. I think it's a great render engine. I love the look of it. We're going to be using it for a project soon that we just can't quite get the look I want in Blender with cycles. So we're gonna look at rendering it in Octane. But it's definitely something to keep your eye on. And when Brigade comes out, it probably will be worth just dropping everything and learning how to use it, because I promise you it'll be used for virtual production with Unreal. So it'll be Octane for Unreal. And the people who know how to use it, I think, will have a real leg up from the people who have no idea. But yeah, I could talk about it for hours, and I'm happy to. If you want to continue the conversation offline, whoever asked the question, you know, feel free to send me a message and we can chat about it. I have a lot of videos on it too.
Awesome. What time frame are we looking for on that? It's available now.
What is?
The Brigade in for working.
Oh yeah, Brigade. I don't know when this is actually going to be released. It's probably. Okay. Probably going to be released in a few months, but they've been saying that, literally been saying that for years. So, they said it was going to be released like 5 years ago, and it hasn't been released yet. However, now is different, because in the regular version of Octane, they've implemented a lot of the Brigade features. And they've done that specifically because they're getting ready to release. And I know that it's being used in closed beta. So I know that it does exist and it can work. So, I don't know what the timeline is, and I'm not holding my breath, but it's probably going to be before the end of the year is my guess.
One last question that I want to ask you is about 360 video in virtual production, because this, mm-hmm. this 360 yeah. video industry had a boom at the VR,
yeah,
like, you know, 6-7 years ago, whenever that was, and then dropped a little, but now you're seeing it come back with virtual production, being able to use 360 plates on LED walls.
Yeah. No, it's definitely, especially with driving plates, you know, if you can, and with car process stuff, you know, you really, a lot of times when, you know, whether you're shooting at car stage or wherever you're shooting, a lot of times you do have somewhat of a wraparound plus a ceiling, and to get all the reflections to look correct and to look, you know, natural, you know, it really benefits you to shoot, to either capture in 360 or to stitch them in post in 360. And there's a lot of benefits. You know, I'm doing a lot of work with Quasar Science, who has a lighting volume in downtown LA. And so you get all the lighting sort of for free just by just throwing in a 360 image. And you can do some really, really cool things using 360 video in virtual production. There are limitations, and like there are with anything, you know, that you can't move around a 360 image, obviously. So you're not going to get crazy parallax or anything like that. But especially if you're doing anything moving with a car, I don't want to say it doesn't matter, but it almost doesn't, you know, that stuff doesn't really matter. You get the parallax from the foreground elements. And same could be true, said for, you know, for 360 videos as well. You could have, if they're your background image and you have a whole set, and you're shooting, and you get all the parallax from the foreground anyway. So yeah, there's a lot of efficiencies. It's also, it's kind of funny that it comes full circle, you know, that with 360, that my knowledge of 360 and how to shoot it and how to stitch it, is important. We have we recently became partners with drivingplates.com. So they have a new red rig that they're capturing a bunch of stuff on, and we're their stitching partner. So we're going to be stitching a lot of their stuff with red rigs and, yeah, and it's great, and the technology has come so far on the stitching side than it was when we were stitching back in the day, that you know, it's a great tool.
Great. Well, a couple of the last little questions to squeeze in here, and we'll take two more, and then we're okay. Done.
Yeah.
But somebody is asking about AI and non-player character conversations in Unreal Engine that just came out, that you can speak to non-player characters with your own voice. Do you know anything about that?
No, I know which video they're talking about. I don't know too much about it. They've even had ways of doing this before with IBM Watson, which is an AI assisted thing, where you could do something similar. But I don't know that I have much to say. You know, I haven't actually played around with it myself, and I don't know that I have much to add to the conversation. Certainly nothing more than what's already in that video. I think it's interesting. I definitely think like the future of games and like, you know, what kind of games my kids are going to play is kind of like, it's equally exciting and terrifying. It's like, you know, you can talk to these players and they can have a whole life of their own that like for better or for worse. But I do think, you know, the optimist in me goes like, man, that's going to be so cool when you can have like an entire game built around non-playable characters that have a life of its own that only you will ever experience because of the questions you asked and how you asked them and what the training model was at that time, how they answer. You know, I think as a creator, as a thinking more of a filmmaker, you want to direct your audience in a specific way. You don't want them to go off and branch into, but as a game developer, you do want the life, your game to have a life of its own, to exist long after you've gone and to continue on forever. So it's a crazy world that we're going to be in for sure. But
We'll see where it goes.
Yeah.
To be continued. Last question then. What are your thoughts on volumetric video and Unreal Engine?
And Unreal Engine for people, I see. So two different questions. So volumetric video is interesting. I've known about it for a long time. There's a thing called MetaStage. I was good friends with the people who were there. We were doing volumetric video. We were doing live volumetric video at John 2016. And actually that's Verizon bought Jump for that technology, the volumetric video side of it, not for the VR 360 stuff. But there's still so many problems with it. And especially and I guess this kind of does go in with Unreal Engine for people, like you have metahumans, which still don't quite, even with someone who's really talented, you don't really pass the uncanny valley. It still looks, in my opinion, it still looks creepy. It's like, okay, great for background people. And I guess this sort of answers the second part of the question. Like Unreal Engine for background people isn't awesome. Great. You can have them do whatever you want. You can change the wardrobe later. You can do all this sort of stuff that might be hard to do crowd simulation with real people. Volumetric video, same way. You know, it's not cost effective if you're going to put volumetric people, you know, for a crowd sim, but you can get really amazing results. But for close up stuff, there's still too many barriers, too many issues with the capture that, you know, it can make sense for very specific reasons. And a great example is for AAA talent. You know, if you want to have Tom Cruise do something, well, that's it. Sure, capture him in volumetric video. And also at that point, who cares about the artifacts? It's Tom Cruise. Like, cool, we have Tom Cruise saying the thing. However, if you want to capture some unknown actor playing a bit in this piece that ultimately no one's going to care about, I mean, maybe do that as a metahuman, or maybe do it on green screen, or, you know, it kind of as everything, it kind of depends on the use case. For training, it could also make a lot of sense. Like if you have somebody showing how to do some very complex skill with volumetric video, that could be very interesting, because then you get the perspective of walking around this person as they're, you know, taking apart and putting together some piece of equipment. But specifically thinking about film and television, and virtual production, I think it's right now, I personally feel like foreground elements, if you're trying to make it photoreal, foreground elements should be real people played by real people. and then, you know, metahumans and volumetric video and stuff could be great for background. It could be great for, putting things, giving life to a scene. But I still think we're still a ways away before we're using metahumans and people don't know the difference between a human and not, because there's still a human element that you just can't quite capture. Even doing it with motion capture technology, there's still something that's just not quite real. But I don't know. I mean, I'm obviously very excited about it. My Alessio, who we just hired, He's a MetaHumans expert. He knows a lot about, you know, how to rig and animate and do the stuff. He does some great work. I hope he can prove me wrong sooner than later, but that's my personal opinion. It's been my opinion for a long time with digital humans. People have asked many times, if people ask me, oh, can we do digital human assessment? I'm like, it'll cost you 10x and you're not going to be happy with the result. If you really want it to look real, do it with a real human, whether that's green screen, whether that's otherwise, do it with a real human. But it's definitely interesting where it's going.
Yeah, the pace of the innovation is extraordinary at the moment as well. So I'm sure we'll see a lot of improvements in a short period of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Thank you, Alex. I really appreciate your joining us today. Thank you for your insights. Thank you for your time. Thank you for being a part of this episode.
Yeah, thanks. Definitely. Thank you for having me. Thank you for all you're doing for the community and the podcast. I'm really excited to see where CG Empowers goes as well. Thank you guys for joining in. And, you know, if you're live and if you're listening to this later, you know, definitely feel free to reach out to me. I'm very busy, but I do love to continue the conversations. I'm also not very secretive of my knowledge. I'd love to give away trade secrets or whatever, because it's all a community, and I very strongly feel like a rising tide lifts all boats. So feel free to reach out.
I echo your sentiment. And is there anything you want to share with the community? Any links or places to follow your work or any things that you're working on?
Yeah, I mean, I think lightsailvr.com is where you can, you can find out more about us. And in there, if you go to the virtual production tab, you'll see, you know, who our partners are. We work a lot with Assimilate Live Effects, which I think is a really powerful program that people are just now really starting to get to understand. Quasar Science is another big partner of ours. Drivingplates.com, as I mentioned. And, you know, I think, I have a YouTube channel where I do tutorials and whatnot. You can find me there. But I think all that you can get to from our website.
Great. Well, thank you again. Appreciate having you on the episode and look forward to the course, obviously, the blended course, and seeing what the future holds.
Yeah, man. I'm excited.
Me too. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today. Thank you for being a part of this episode as well, asking great questions and participating and making it what it was today. If you enjoyed today, you can follow us in our Facebook group or at becomecgpro.com to find out more about what we do as a school. And look forward to seeing you all again in a couple of weeks for another episode of the CG Pro podcast. Thank you all. Have a great day.